Sri Sukha Uvacha, Ambarisho Mahabhaga, Sapta Dvipa Vatim Mahim, Avyayam Chashriyam Labhva, Vibhavan Chakulam Dvi, Mene Tidur Labham Pungsam, Sargam Tat Svapna Sangstukam, Vitam Vibhava Nirvanam, Tamo Vishati Yat Kumar. Translation. Shukadev Goswami said, Maharaj Ambarish, the most fortunate personality, achieved the rule of the entire world consisting of seven islands and achieved inexhaustible, unlimited opulence and prosperity on earth. Although such a position is rarely obtained, Maharaj Ambarish did not care for it at all. For he knew very well that all such opulence is material. Like that which is imagined in a dream, such opulence will ultimately be destroyed. The king knew that any non-devotee who attains such opulence merges increasingly into material nature's mode of darkness. Srila Prabhupada's purport. For a devotee, material opulence is insignificant, whereas for a non-devotee, material opulence is the cause of increasing bondage. For a devotee knows that anything material is temporary, whereas a non-devotee regards the temporary so-called happiness as everything and forgets the path of self-realization. Thus, for the non-devotee, material opulence is a disqualification for material happiness. Om jnana tamirantasya jnanam jana shlokaya chakshurun militam jena tasmai shri gurave namaha. Mukam karoti vachalam pangum langhayate gidim jat kripa tamahum bande shri gurun dinatam. Ma om vishnu padaya krishna preshtaya bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Sarasati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pastatya Desha Tarine Vancha Kalpatarubhyastra Kripa Sindhobhya Eva Chapatitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namo. Jaladhara Sachivarnau Gopaveshau Kishorau Sapachara Ganavindai Kridamana Vajeshau Natavada Jitavesha Nilapitam Bharatya Jagatachananahe to Ramakrishna Matosmi. From Nabhaga, Maharaj Ambarish took birth. Maharaj Ambarish was an exalted devotee celebrated for his great merits. Although he was cursed by an infallible Brahmana, the curse could not touch him. King Parikit inquired, "Oh, great personality, Maharaj Ambarish was certainly most exalted and meritorious in character. I wish to hear about him. How surprising it is that the curse of a Brahmana which is insurmountable could not act upon him." Shukadeva Goswami said, "Maharaj Ambarish, the most fortunate personality, achieved the rule of the entire world consisting of seven islands and achieved inexhaustible, unlimited opulence and opulence and prosperity on earth. Although such a position is rarely obtained, Maharaj Ambarish did not care for it at all, for he knew very well that all such opulence is material. Like that which is imagined in a dream, such opulence will ultimately be destroyed. The king knew that any non-devotee who attains such opulence merges increasingly into material nature's mode of darkness." So, Maharaj Parikit found this very interesting. Shukadeva Goswami briefly recounted the activities and character of King Nabhaga, who, as Kamahar explained yesterday, demonstrated so many good qualities. And then he said that his son was Ambarish, and although he was celebrated for his great merits, and he was cursed by an infallible Brahmana, Durvasa Muni, pretty heavy character, the curse couldn't touch him. Ah, now this gets Parikit's attention, yeah? Because this is kind of close to home. He was cursed, Brahmashapa. We can hear this from the beginning of the first canto. Parikit was cursed by a Brahmin boy, an inexperienced Brahmin. And, of course, he could have, taken shelter of the Lord in such a way that the curse might have been counteracted, but he chose not to. He saw it as a great opportunity. And here, he sees that Maharaj Ambarish, cursed by a very experienced brahmana, especially at cursing, such as Durvasa Muni, the curse couldn't even touch him. He wanted to hear that story. After all, what else does Maharaj Briket have to do than to hear the pastimes of Krishna and his devotees, his Mahabhagavat devotees? So he found this very interesting. And one of the things that characterized Maharaj Ambarish was that although he had, practically speaking, access to all the opulence in the world, he didn't care, as Srila Prabhupada often said, a fig for it. We have other ways to say that in our culture. Srila Prabhupada also had a nice way of describing us sometimes. Basically, called us, said we have gobar for brains. We have cow dung for brains. And I thought, yeah, my company commander in boot camp used to say the same thing, but not quite so gently. He had names for us that sounded just almost like that. So Srila Prabhupada, you know, might say that Maharaj Ambarish, although he had access to practically all the opulence in the world, didn't care a fig for it. And that's because he had something else. He had something better. Of the six characteristics of bhakti, yesterday Tamahar discussed kleshagni, the first one, brings immediate relief from all material distress. But one of the other characteristics is moksha laghuta. It makes even moksha look insignificant. Laghuta makes it look lightweight, not at all heavy. And let's face it, in the cultures from which we come, real moksha, real liberation from material distress isn't even a concept that people can relate to. They can hardly relate to dharma. Some sense of duty, maybe even dressed up by religiosity, you might see a little of that in people nowadays. Real religiosity, very rare. Because we don't see that advertised very much. If we see the sense of duty advertised at all, it's like for life insurance. You know, you see those commercials, the ads in the magazines, or I guess they have commercials on television as well. You know, if you were to go away tomorrow, what would become of your family? And that's, it awakens fear tinged by a sense of duty. The main thing that advertisers use is fear. Many years ago, my sister gave me a book called Cash Copy, and it was the key to writing good advertising copy. And the heart of that was arouse fear in the readers. Arouse a sense of fear, and then you're going to come in. And so any sense of duty that there is really based on some kind of fear. Oh, what'll they say about me? If I were to die without a big life insurance policy, my wife and kids will just curse me, and everybody will say nasty things about me after I die, and I don't want that. Artha, well, everybody is supposed to work hard in order to accumulate some opulence. And some people are actually able to do that. And a few years ago, it seemed like the kind of wealth that would be available even to ordinary people might be boundless. And out where I live on the Big Island, we saw the price of property skyrocket. And that's not really hyperbole. We saw it skyrocket. The lots, 1 acre lots across the road from us were maybe $8,000-$10,000 when we bought our place. And 2 years later, maybe, People had them on the market for $110,000. And everybody just thought, oh, and people were snapping up lots out there like crazy for speculation, build houses on to sell. Because it seemed, and I heard people say this, this doesn't have to stop. This economic growth, this real estate growth, this doesn't have to stop. And I'm sitting there thinking, wait a minute, I'm not even 60 years old, and I've been through this a few times. We've seen this. How short are people's memories? Of course it has to stop. And the bigger we grow, the bigger we blow this bubble, the more catastrophic the pop when it does burst. And here we go. A couple of years ago, we had it. So that's also an illusion. And a few people do get rich. A few people who really know how to manipulate the market. And like I sometimes think of Bill Gates. Bill Gates became at one point the wealthiest man in the world by selling cheesy products. Anybody who really understands computer operating systems, as my friend Srikanta explained to me 25 years or so ago, MS-DOS is really far inferior to, I can't remember what the prime operating system for PC was before Gates started marketing MS-DOS. But it's actually a cheesy product. And anybody who's used Microsoft products knows how easy it is for them to crash and get bugs. I mean, what program over the last few years got bugs more than Microsoft Outlook? People who have Macs and didn't use Outlook didn't get a lot of these viruses and worms that were going around. But people who used Microsoft Outlook had to watch out almost every other week. He became very, very wealthy selling second-rate products because he is very good at marketing. Now, he quit his job of making a lot of money in order to make his full-time job figuring out how to give that money away now. So that's a nice thing. And therefore, he was celebrated a couple of years along with his wife and the rock singer Bono as a Times Person of the Year because giving away a lot of money. But that's what everybody's about. Artha, so we can get some sense gratification, so we can get karma. But the idea of moksha is a completely foreign thing, except to a few people. And a lot of them will become impersonalists or Buddhists. Their whole thing, the Buddhist thing is, how can we be relieved of the suffering that we find ourselves drowning in? That's their ultimate goal, is some kind of relief from suffering. But if you get devotional service, that makes even moksha, which is beyond sense gratification, which is the imputed result of economic development, makes it look lightweight, makes it look like a feather, blow away on any breeze. So real wealth, Maharaj Ambarish wasn't distracted by all this other wealth because he understood that real wealth is devotional service to Krishna. Now, most of us are still working on that. We understand. We may understand intellectually that this is what life is really all about. I was visiting my daughter recently, and she had this old Mangalananda albums, and one of them was talking about how devotion to Krishna is, I think the line is, life's only goal. And if we may intellectually understand that, but we still find ourselves distracted by trying to get wealth. I remember back in the, maybe it was late 70s, early 80s, there'd be these multi-level marketing schemes that would go around ISKCON, and I don't remember seeing anybody actually making any money off of it. There was some dairy product thing, I can't remember, made out of some product based on whey or something like that. I don't remember seeing any of the devotees who really got into that making any money. And there were even, I knew some men who were even into the 80s and into the 90s, I saw these pyramid schemes going around. And I mean, this is a really nasty way to try to make money, because it's purely victimizing other people, because somebody, just like this so-called economic boom that we just had, people get left I'm holding the an empty bag full of something very unpleasant. Well, an empty bag if you're lucky, and if not, if you're not so lucky, a bag of something very unpleasant. So what we want is to try to emulate Maharaj Ambarish and understand his wisdom by understanding what is real wealth. And real wealth is what Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to give. And early in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishnadas Kaviraj explains it a couple of ways, but in one place he says that the Lord came for two reasons. Prema rasa niryas korite ashvadan, rag marga bhakti loke korite pracharana. One, to taste rasa himself, that he can't taste as himself. And the other, to preach raganuga bhakti, to preach the kind of bhakti that the residents of Vrindavan live in. And therefore, he's considered to be Patitapavana, the best friend of the most fallen. So, sometimes I've talked about Sharanagati, and I've cited the verses from a few places that Lord Chaitanya cites in his instructions to Sanatana Goswami in Madhya Lila, how the verse is meant to support the idea that the heart of surrender is taking complete, accepting Krishna as your sole guardian and maintainer. And one of them is a verse from the Ramayana where Lord Ramchandra says that it's my vow that if someone seriously surrenders to me, saying, "My dear Lord, from this day I'm yours," and prays to me for courage, I shall immediately award courage to him, to that person, and he'll always remain safe from that time on. And those of us who were involved with Gurukulas in the old days, I know at least at Bhaktivedanta Village, you know, the students would every day would recite these a couple of verses from Chaitanya Charitamrita, at least the translation. My dear Lord Krishna, although I've forgotten you for so many long years in this material world, now I am surrendering unto you. I am your sincere and serious servant. My dear Lord, from this day I am yours. Something I've been practicing for, I remember reading those in teachings of Lord Chaitanya back when I joined early in 1970. And my old falling apart teachings of Lord Chaitanya still has that thing underlined, asterisked, and highlighted. Because I found that very significant. I thought, oh, maybe this will help. So I've been kind of practicing those for the last 40, 41 years. But I haven't, when I've discussed this is kind of where I stop. But Lord Chaitanya goes on a little farther, and it's because he explains how this works, why this is so. So he says, due to bad association, the living entity desires material happiness, liberation, or merging into the impersonal aspect of the Lord, or he engages in mystic yoga for material power. If such a person actually becomes intelligent, he takes to Krishna consciousness by engaging himself in intense devotional service to the Lord. Now this verse begins, bhukti mukti siddhi kami subuddhi yadi hoy. So bhukti mukti siddhi kami, we know that. Bhukti mukti siddhi kami sakali ashanta, right? Those who are addicted to bhukti mukti siddhi, to these kinds of things, these three things, they're never peaceful. Krishna bhakta nishkama ate eva shanta, because the Krishna's devotees don't have any of these desires. They're actually peaceful. So then he says, whether one desires, and then he cites the Bhagavatam verse, akama sarva karma va moksha kama udaradhi tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusha param. Whether one desires everything or nothing, or whether he desires to merge into the existence of the Lord, he's intelligent only if he worships Lord Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by rendering transcendental loving service. And then he says, Lord Chaitanya says, if those who desire material sense and material enjoyment are merging into the existence of the Absolute Truth, engage in the Lord's transcendental service, they will immediately attain shelter at Krishna's lotus feet, although they did not ask for it. Krishna is therefore very merciful. He gives you something you didn't even ask for. If you engage in devotional service, even with some ulterior motive, Krishna gives you shelter at his lotus feet. Tomohar Prabhu was talking yesterday about. It's not really a deal. It's better than a deal. It's a cheat. Right? What do they call it? I can't remember the business term for it, but it's, you know, they're offering you one thing and you end up getting something else. Huh? Bait and switch. However, usually you get something that's not as good as the bait, right? Here, he dangles the bait and you get the real thing. So that's Krishna's character. And then Krishna's, Mahaprabhu gives us some insight into Krishna's mentality. If one engages in my transcendental loving service, but at the same time wants the opulence of material enjoyment, he's very, very foolish. Indeed, he's just like a person who gives up ambrosia to drink poison. And then he says, Ami vigae murki vishai keni diva. Since I'm very intelligent, why should I give this idiot material prosperity? He's not very bright, but I'm bright. I'm smarter than he is, so why should I give him that? It's going to hurt him. Why should I give it to him? Instead, I'll induce him, so he's dangling the bait, in order to get him to take the nectar of the shelter of my lotus feet and make him forget illusory material enjoyment. Whenever Krishna is requested to fulfill, he cites a Bhagavatam verse, whenever Krishna is requested to fulfill one's desire, he undoubtedly does so, but he does not award anything which after being enjoyed will cause him to petition him again and again to fulfill further desires. We see this happens in the material world. No matter how much we get, we're never satisfied. I mean, I'm thinking of Bill Gates. This guy was making, well, the colloquial term is more money than God, at least more money than Oprah Winfrey. And he still was trying to get more and more. And we see in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam, that's one of the qualities of a Vaishya, right? Unlimited desire for material gain. He says, when he has other desires but engages in the Lord's service, Krishna forcibly gives one shelter at his lotus feet, where one will forget all other desires. When someone engages in Lord Krishna's devotional service for the satisfaction of the senses and instead acquires a taste for serving Krishna, he gives up his material desires and willingly offers himself as an eternal servant of Krishna. And then he cites a verse from Hari Bhakti Sudhodaya, even the title of that work. I don't know of any other verses from that work. Hari Bhakti Sudhodaya, the auspicious dawning of devotional service to Krishna, kind of a neat title. Srila Prabhupada often cited, Sthanabhilasi tapasistitoham tvam praptivam devam munim druguhyam kacham vichanvan api divya ratnam svamin kritartosmi varang mayache. So this is Dhruva Maharaj. After receiving darshan of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and being blessed by him to have more than what he came for, Shyamananda, do you remember what Dhruva Maharaj went to the forest looking for? What he wanted to get? What he was going to ask Krishna for when he found him? You don't remember? Oh, back to school. Very beginning of summer vacation and already we've forgotten everything. Dhruva Maharaj wanted a kingdom. What kind of kingdom? A big kingdom, right? He wanted sthanabhilasi. He wanted the greatest position in the material world. He wanted a kingdom even better than his grandfather's, even bigger and better than that of Lord Brahma. That's what he went to the forest for. He was upset. He'd been put down by his brother and his stepmother, literally, right? Stepmother induced his father just to let him down off his lap. You know, this boy does not. I'm his favorite wife. You're not born out of my womb, so you don't get any of his attention. Dhruva, being a Kshatriya, of course, he was incensed, went home huffing and puffing. You can kind of picture anybody who's got a 4, 5, or 6-year-old kid knows that look. All of a sudden their face clouds over, the eyes get red, the tears well up, and they just they can't control their breath, and oh my God, here, oh, what is it now? And so he asks his mother, how am I going to get this? He says, well, look, I don't know anything about this stuff, but I've heard that saintly people, listen, frankly, it's only the Supreme Personality of Godhead that's going to be able to satisfy a desire like this one. This is a pretty big one. Okay, so where do I find him? Where's his office? Well, I don't know, but I hear that great sages and saintly people go to the forest to find him. out the door, down the road, and off to the forest. And he engages in unthinkable austerities for 6 months, gaining such control over the life air in his body that it actually chokes up the breathing of the universe, and then all the demigods have to approach the Lord to kind of stop things. Became so powerful. And the Lord says, "Oh, don't worry, I got it covered. I know who it is. It's just this Dhruva. I'll take care of it." He goes, he gives his darshan to Dhruva, and he gives him more than he asked for, but still the ultimate in material opulence. But after seeing the Lord, Dhruva thinks, "God, I have ripped myself off. I'm such a dope. I walked into this again." And so he says, "I'm so foolish that I went through all these austerities just so that I could get the greatest position in the material world. It's as if I were out looking for pieces of broken glass. But now I found you, the most valuable diamond." In the Bhagavatam, he says, "I feel like a poor man who, when the king offers him whatever he wants, the king were to offer him half his kingdom, he says, 'Actually, you got some cheap rice, some junk rice. I'll take a handful of junk rice. I don't really need all that much right now.'" So here he's saying, "I found the most valuable gem when I was out looking for pieces of broken glass." So this is our position. We're rooting around in the material world looking for pieces of broken glass, looking for junk rice. I think I might have told this story before, please forgive me. Maybe about 30 years ago, two young Mormon elders approached our home in Honolulu, and they spent maybe an hour trying to convince me to invite them back for a 45-minute presentation on the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I knew a little something about about the real goal of that religion, which is to, as most of us know, become the heavenly father of some universe. It's not really about surrendering to the... I mean, they don't even talk about what we call the Supreme Personality of Godhead. They only talk about our Heavenly Father, and that's like somebody like Lord Brahma. So that's the ultimate goal of their religion. And I told them, I said, they said, "Well, don't you want your little daughter over there, don't you want her crawling, don't you want her to have the best thing?" And I said, "Yeah, but it's not some cheesy..." Back then, back in the 50s and 60s and maybe even into the 70s, if something was cheap, thing was made in Japan. Nowadays, we go crazy to buy a Japanese car or a Japanese television or whatever. Of course, nowadays, even those are made in China. But back then, made in Japan was kind of a code word for junk, something cheesy. And we had our transistor radios in the 50s that we were so proud of that were made in Japan. So I said, "Yeah, but I'm not talking about getting some cheesy made-in-Japan universe that's going to, last for a few years and then wear out." So that's really garbage. Your ultimate goal is the first thing we reject, this whole business of controlling a universe. We don't want that. We know that doesn't satisfy. So anyway, these gentlemen went away a little upset. I told them, "Look, if you come back to my house, I'm making the 45-minute presentation." So they went away not very happy. Usually you're able to satisfy these folks, but these boys were a little passionate, and so they weren't very happy when they went away. But that's ultimately our situation. We're looking for some cheesy 1950s made-in-Japan transistor radio, thinking that is the cat's meow. Oh, my God, now I've gone back to my father's generation. But that happens when you're old. But that will not satisfy us, and we actually should have some experience of that. We've tried in different ways throughout our lives. Some of us are a little younger, but even if you're still in school, you might have, if you're a little reflective or you've got parents who force you to behave reflectively, you might have seen that the things that you've tried to get didn't really satisfy you. Think of, maybe the devotees' kids don't have much experience of it, but Christmas morning. You know, you wake up, you can't, you can hardly get to sleep Christmas Eve. You wake up in the middle of the night Christmas morning, sometimes while Santa is still there, with all this anticipation, and there's all this loot, and a lot of it loses its shine, you know, before you even have Christmas dinner. Most of the stuff doesn't even, you know, it's not exciting a week later on New Year's Eve. So it's not a difficult experience to get. All we have to do is have the experience of having desires, having those desires fulfilled, and realizing those don't really satisfy us. That's not real wealth. Real wealth is something that gives us actual value, actual good. And ultimately, that just means pure devotional service. Everything else is cheesy. I've talked much longer than I intended. Any quick comments or questions? I can read the verses again, too. They're nice. From Nabhaga, Maharaj Ambarish took birth. Maharaj Ambarish was an exalted devotee celebrated for his great merits. Although he was cursed by an infallible brahmana, the curse could not touch him. King Parikit inquired, "O great personality, Maharaj Ambarish was certainly most exalted and meritorious in character. I wish to hear about him. How surprising it is that the curse of a brahmana, which is insurmountable, could not act upon him." Shukadev Goswami said, "Maharaj Ambarish, the most fortunate personality, achieved the rule of the entire world, consisting of seven islands, and achieved inexhaustible, unlimited opulence and prosperity on earth. Although such a position is rarely obtained, Maharaj Ambarish did not care for it at all, for he knew very well that all such opulence is material. Like that which is imagined in a dream, such opulence will ultimately be destroyed. The king knew that any non-devotee who attains such opulence merges increasingly into material nature's mode of darkness." Comments or questions? This is a reminder from our sponsor, right? Kind of building a little bit on some of the things that Tamahar said yesterday. Shesha Prabhu?
You were saying how devotional service to Krishna is real wealth. We try to attain wealth to maintain ourselves, you know, put bread on the table. And how does, like, devotional service to Krishna, you know, satisfy that as being wealth? I mean, just the maintenance part of our...
Well, it's a big question because it depends on how you conceive of yourself, who you see yourself to be. If we see ourselves as the material body that's defined by all the things that we possess or desire, then pure devotional service may or may not. Now, the thing is, it depends on the faith. The extent to which that happens depends on the faith that we have in that devotional service. Because, as I've mentioned many times, the core characteristic of surrender, of sharanagati, is goptritvevaranam, accepting Krishna as your... As your sole guardian, your exclusive guardian and maintainer. And doing that may entail giving up striving for these things at all and waiting for whatever scraps he may throw. As Bhaktivinoda Thakur expresses in one of his songs on Goptritvevaranam. Let me be your dog, tie me up outside your house, and let whatever scraps the devotees leave behind be my food. So we think of artha as, artha means something of value. But actually all the things that we're working for are ultimately unartha. And our striving for these things, even if we dress it up as religion, is actually a form of cheating, because that's about me. My practicing religion so I can go to heaven, my working hard and paying my taxes and everything so that I can have a nice, comfortable life, and enjoy sense gratification, and ultimately my liberation. That's about me. But devotional service is about Krishna. And it's that that gives life to the devotees. Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that in his introduction to Sharanagati. That devotional service is the life. It's the life force of the devotees. So it's a matter of how we conceive of ourselves. And by practice, as Tamahar Prabhu was saying yesterday, by practicing sadhana, we're supposed to clarify our conception of ourselves. As I was explaining to someone last week, that sense of who we are, defined by all the stuff that we have and all the stuff that we want and the regrets that we have over the things that we've lost, that's who we think we are. And as long as that's our self-concept, our picture of who we are, then we have to strive for those things. And no matter what we do, we're not going to be satisfied. But if we actually, if the mirror of our heart becomes progressively cleansed and we see progressively clearly who we actually are, then we see what real sustenance, what real maintenance really is, really are, what real life really is. And so then we attain for the ultimate valuable thing, the fifth artha, panchama artha, prema pumarto maha. This is the greatest thing of value. So these things have value only to the extent that they maintain us. If they fail to maintain us, then we curl our lip in disgust and reject them. But if we understand that they don't really maintain us, we understand that it's like a dream. All the stuff that we wanted, it's like the dream. When we're experiencing the dream, it's very vivid, and we're thinking, oh, wow, that's really something. And you wake up, and before you even make it to the bathroom, it's like vapor in the room, or like a smoke ring or something, you know? Smoke ring looks really cool. You know, you make a smoke ring, and it's hanging there in the air. But how long does it last? It falls apart. As soon as all the particles start to cool, it sort of falls apart. Or if somebody opens the door and walks in the room, it's gone. So all the stuff that we've done is just like that vape, just like the fog. As soon as the sun comes out, it dissipates. Or the smoke ring. As soon as something happens, it's gone. So all this value, all this so-called sustenance and maintenance, it hasn't worked God knows how many times. So it's really a matter of who we think we are, and the extent to which we're convinced that we're something other than all these things that we use to define ourselves in the material world. Mathura?
I mentioned yesterday I've been studying a lot about Varnashram, and Prabhupada actually, about the economic situation, Prabhupada said every temple should have a Varnashram college. So to me that seems like the economic solution, because my question is, why are classes and the philosophy we're speaking not more integrated with this? It feels to me like we're still back in the 60s and 70s, just speaking about basically the philosophy Prabhupada was presenting in order to make Brahmins. And now we have to actually start taking care of the families and educating the families how they can take care of themselves and not be entangled in the material world. So, I mean, I'm struggling. I'm like going, what's the solution? And I'm really suffering because of it. And I've tried some businesses, I tried this, and it's just... So my question is, why is this not happening? And to me, this seems like the solution to every devotee is struggling who's a grihasta economically.
It means living differently than we're accustomed to. Nice big air-conditioned house with a nice car and cable TV and iPhone and all that stuff. Not very easy, not very well sustained by living in a plywood shack on a few acres with a couple of cows and an organic garden. They're really different lives. So in order to make it happen, we have to do it. We have to understand what it means and then do it. So you have, how many devotees do we have in ISKCON nowadays? So many, I don't know, 100 some thousand or something like that. We probably have about 30,000 ideas of what Varnashram, what it means to implement Varnashram Dharma. and we haven't seen any of them very successfully implemented so far. There are some people who are working on some projects. So if that's how you, if that's what you want to do, if you want to make that happen, then you have to find one. Either do one of those projects yourself, get one of those projects going yourself, which unfortunately takes some money, which is where a lot of us got lured in to these to the jobs that we've had. I'll get some money, then I'll buy a few acres and, you know, live the simple life. Forget it. Or find somebody else who's doing it and just go there, whatever it takes. That's a huge leap of faith. I've known devotees who've done that and been disappointed the efforts that they found and end up coming. One friend of mine owned some land and a house on the Big Island, sold it, went to India for some so-called eco-varnashram program or something, and now he lives in an apartment in Honolulu and drives a taxi because it didn't work out. So it's a leap of faith, and you have to really commit yourself. And if it doesn't work out very well at the beginning, you have to be willing to really just push through whatever that is. It's the same thing with our sadhana. At a certain point, it seems like overcoming our desires is going to be impossible, and we just have to kind of push through that over and over and over again. So if you're convinced that that's the solution, then somehow or other you have to make it happen. Sitting around waiting for somebody else to do it, or spending our entire adult lives trying to develop our own unique idea of what that means, because if you don't have your own idea, you're not a Muni, right? That's not going to do it, because that's what we've been doing for the last 30 some odd years. So if while that's going on, we're still preaching Prema Kumarto Mahan, where's the fault there? You do what you can. We have our limitations. There was a devotee in San Diego, a little unglued in some ways, who was fanatical about Varnashram, and he would harass people. Actually, he ran into me in the library at the university where I taught, and followed me around and harassed me about Varnashram Dharma at my workplace, and I threatened to have him arrested for harassing me at my workplace because I couldn't escape it. He didn't have any idea how to implement it. He just said everybody else has to do it. But if we're convinced that that's what's going to happen, if that's what's going to make things, that's going to change things, then we just have to do it. We have to make a commitment to making it, to making the attempt, and take the chance on it not working out right. Srila Prabhupada admitted that he was experimenting with what he was doing with Krishna consciousness. He tried some things, they didn't work out so well, and so he tried something else. And he tried making, emphasizing that everybody should become a brahmana, and at one point he saw that wasn't working out so well, so then he said, okay, so then the second half is varnashram dharma, for those who can't live like that. But I know some devotees who've lived like that. I'm thinking of Apurva and Kamalini. Their kids seem to have their heads on pretty straight. They didn't have a lot of money. Their thing was, devotee starts some restaurant, okay, let's run a restaurant. Let's run the restaurant and live however simply we have to do that. And, many of us have met both their kids. Their kids came out okay. Gaurangi Priya is a wonderful Bharatanatyam teacher and a wonderful devotee. And anybody whose heart doesn't melt when Amala leads a kirtan, doesn't have a heart. They turned out okay. So, it's a matter of our conviction. I have to stop. Thank you very much for your attention. I apologize for anybody who didn't get to have their say.